Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Today we're talking about energy conservation. Winter weather arrived earlier than usual last week, and with that, energy demand is up for homes and businesses. Penn Environment recently released a guide for reducing energy consumption called It's Time to Take Charge, a citizen's guide to saving energy. It focuses on reducing energy waste, particularly during colder weather. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection always has some tips on how to save energy, not just during the winter months, but all year round. And that's what we're going to discuss today. Joining us on the program, Ali Aster, who is a clean energy associate with Penn Environment, Environmental Group. Ms. Aster, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also, Mark Hand is an energy program specialist, and Dave Althoff is director of energy programs with the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Thanks.
If you have a question or a comment about energy consumption, saving energy, energy conservation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Ali Aster, I'm going to start with you. Tell me what is behind the idea of the guide, It's Time to Take Charge, a citizen's guide to saving energy.
Yeah, so the way that we communicate and shop and work and live have all changed dramatically within the last decade. But the way we produce and consume energy is still very much in the same way that we did over 100 years ago. And these ways that we're consuming and producing our energy are really putting a lot of our most basic needs at risk, like our health, our environment, and our climate. So the way that we see it is it's really a win-win, because we can have better health and a more sustainable environment while also paying lower utility bills. And energy improvements really pay for themselves. So the point of our Citizen's Guide to Reducing Energy Waste is really designed to help families cut through the clutter of information and pick improvements that will maximize their energy savings the most for the ways that they see most fit for their home. So while some energy waste can be due to improper insulation or inefficient heating and cooling systems or out-of-date appliances, there's also smaller things that people can do in their house, such as switching their light bulbs to LEDs or weatherizing their windows and things such as that, that really everyone can get into and everyone can do something to play their part. So we wanted our guide to be a resource that people could really see their best point that they can make the biggest improvements to their home.
DEP has been offering these kind of tips or information for a long time. I think it's something that, just for some of the reasons that Ali Aster mentioned, it probably gets people more attention from consumers today, whether you're a homeowner or a business owner that has to use energy with your business, because some of the reasons she mentioned, saving money could be number one for a lot of people. Health could be another. Environment could be another. But this is something DEP has worked on for a long time, too.
Absolutely. I mean, It's a key part of environmental protection for us. Energy conservation and energy efficiency, the most beneficial unit of energy is the one that you do not have to use. And so ultimately that is energy efficiency. If you do not have to turn the lights on in the room, don't turn the lights on. If you are turning lights on, you should have the most efficient light bulb in that room. So therefore you're using the least amount of energy for the work that needs to be provided. So that's always a very key part from our perspective at the Department of Environmental Protection is that the energy that you do not have to use is the unit of energy that is most clean.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, you know, we've been at this for quite a long time, like you said, and one of the best programs for consumers is the Energy Star program. People recognize the Energy Star label on appliances and lights, and I think that, you know, we need to keep encouraging the use of the Energy Star program. It's a government-backed program. It shows that the product you're purchasing is in the top 15% of the products that are out there in that class. So it's a really easy way to get involved with energy efficiency and purchasing.
Mm-hmm. Ali Aster, one of the things that I have to admit that in your guide that I appreciated the most was there was a list of what used the most energy in our homes. Not surprisingly, cooling and heating was number one. But, number one and number two, I should say. But what may surprise some other people is the water heater in our homes is number three on the list. And I have to admit, I was out of the house for a few days last week and turned the water heater off, or electricity to the water heater off. I'm hoping I save a little bit of money there. But there are a lot of other things that people probably don't realize how much energy they do use in the home.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, actually, when you think about the way that your appliances and the different electronics and technologies we use in our home really do consume a lot more energy than we often think. So, like you said, heating and cooling is a large, is just like around 50% of the energy people use in home is generally towards heating and cooling. But again, things like appliances, as we were just talking about the Energy Star, having appliances that are efficient make a huge difference. As, for example, with refrigerators, a refrigerator from 10 years ago uses an insane amount of energy compared to what refrigerators use today. And actually, just a fact about the Energy Star program, like if all refrigerators in the U.S. were Energy Star certified, it would reduce annual greenhouse gas emissions by about 9 billion pounds. So that just goes to show you how efficient appliances can really make a big difference. But then there's also other things in your home as well that a lot of people don't really think about. So you have your computer on and you have a screensaver versus just shutting it down. That screensaver is using energy and it's costing you money and is requiring more inputs to create the energy that's used to run your computer screensaver. Similarly, phone chargers and computer chargers, these are what we call sometimes energy vampires, which will continue to suck energy even when they're not plugged into the device that they're set to charge. So if you have a phone charger or a computer charger plugged into your wall and it's just kind of sitting there not connected to your computer or phone, it can still be drawing out energy. So it's important to either unplug those or plug them into a power strip that you can shut down when you're done using. Because, again, these things that a lot of people just don't really realize are actually big energy consumers. And like you said, with a water heater, even shutting it off for a few days will make a drastic change in the amount of energy you're using. And especially if you're not going to be home, things like the thermostat, turning it down a few degrees, or shutting off your water heater, all those things can really add up and make a big difference.
I see that you two guys nodding your heads in agreement here.
Yeah, I actually have an interesting story about that personally. So I replaced my water heater about 2 years ago. I'd lived in a home that had an old water heater, and I took advantage of a Act 129 rebate. I live in the PPL service territory. There are a number of programs that are out there that homeowners should check into when considering these types of energy efficiency upgrades. I upgraded from a electric water heater to a heat pump water heater. And it was a very simple process. Actually, one of the most difficult parts of the process for me was making sure that my contractor gave me the right information to submit with the rebate form in order to get my cash rebate, which I believe was about $300. So it helped. The water heater was a little more expensive, but that rebate helped defray the cost. And ultimately, I know that I am saving energy on that water heater. I can see it on my electricity bill.
All right, but something you just said, it was a little more expensive. And I think all three of you can weigh in on this, that there are many people who are living paycheck to paycheck. And even though they may know that, okay, I buy a new water heater, I buy a new refrigerator, I buy a new microwave that would be more energy efficient, they have to buy those things up front, and we could be talking thousands of dollars.
Yeah, one of the things that folks, you know, one of the things you got to focus on with a house first is, you know, the heating and cooling is what we talked about. But with that comes air sealing and insulation. And while those appliances are very expensive, air sealing and insulation, which is actually when you caulk around, pipes and things like that to go to the exterior of your building or into the attic, or adding, you know, bad insulation to complete, you know, the insulation level in your house, those are cheaper items that can be done and very effective at controlling costs through the heating season.
Mm-hmm. We have a listener question here, which I know that the three of you have opinions on. Listener asks, how cost-effective is it to hire a company to conduct an energy audit on our home? What kind of findings do they typically make? Allie, what about that?
Yeah, I was actually just going to chime in and say something about that. So depending on your utility company, there are companies that will do a free home energy audit to help you figure out where in your home will be most effective for you to make energy efficiency improvements. So if you are on a paycheck-to-paycheck basis and really want to find the most bang for your buck, getting an audit will be something that would be very useful because it will allow you to see where you can best put your money to get the greatest output of, like, get the most money back in terms of energy savings. There are some companies as well where you do have to pay, but I think that an energy audit, if you are looking, like I said, to make the best improvements and make the most out of your improvements, I think an energy audit is the way to go because it can be hard for someone to kind of make a, I mean, I'm sure you could guess where you're using energy, but it is helpful to have a professional come in and tell you exactly where you can put resources into fixing and get savings out of that.
Let me ask you this. What's the most efficient form of heating and cooling we have, but heating especially since we're entering the winter season?
Yeah, absolutely. So using, as actually speaking of the heat pump water system, heat pumps for heating and cooling your house are almost twice as efficient as an oil or gas furnace. So while those, as we said, talking about upfront costs, they are going to be more expensive off the bat, their efficiency is much, much higher, and heating and cooling costs, once summer comes around again, will be drastically reduced. And in addition, the nice part about electric heat pumps is also that you don't have the threat of toxic gas coming out of them or any sort of, I don't know, coming as just the potential of having toxic air, like pollutants coming out of your machines. It's also a benefit from the public health perspective because with an electric heat pump, you're not going to have those threats as well.
I'm curious. I'm to our guest in this studio here. I don't hear of very many new homes that have oil furnaces anymore. Do they do that?
I think more and more as we realize what are the more efficient forms of heating and cooling, I think the logical thing to do as we're building new constructions is to move away from the less efficient heating systems, due to both the fact that it will cost the homeowner less money and also will require less inputs from like oil and gas companies. And it's just, I think overall, as we transition into and find new technologies that are really beneficial, much like any other smart technologies, like a smart thermostat or other ways to really control your energy use in a home, I think that being able to transition away from these things that are clearly inefficient is definitely on the rise, and as we find more efficient technologies and things to use in our home, that's the new kind of what people are going to go for. Yeah. But that being said, I don't think that everywhere is going to be not installing furnaces and such, because in some places that may be what they still see as the best practice.
And in Pennsylvania, people have been moving away from fuel oil and heating oil for some time, and it mostly just because of the cost of the fuel. But Energy Star and all these programs, you can buy very efficient heating sources, not just heat pumps, but you can buy, very efficient furnaces that are 90% efficient gas or propane or heating oil. So all those options are there. And not everyone can really transition to a heat pump. It's not really maybe practical. Their house isn't set up for it. So some people may be looking into other types of furnaces or Air Force, furnaces and boilers and things like that that their house has already been set up for.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Yes, we had a blast of winter weather last week. We're still talking about it, still recovering from it. But what it reminded a lot of people of, in fact, probably a lot of people turned the heat on for the first time last week, but that we're talking about energy conservation, ways to save energy, ways to save money, what's good for the environment, a lot of different topics that are rolled into one. Our guest today, Ali Astor, Clean Energy Associate with Penn Environment, Mark Hand, Energy Program Specialist, and Dave Althoff, Director of Energy Programs, both with the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Gary in Juniata County. Gary, you're on the air.
I've got a lot of things through my mind. Most of the things are, you know, why Pennsylvania, you know, with all the billions of dollars, can't set up like a $50 million energy bank so that low-income families can go in and say, listen, I'd like to replace my water heater with a more efficient one, and the savings could help make my payments on the loan. So technically, they're, you know, the bank would eventually get their money back. Something, and then maybe the low-income weatherization people could go in and assess the home and say, listen, here's what we can do for you, but if you could just do this little bit extra, we can help you get a low-interest loan from this energy bank. So it isn't just, you know, another bureaucratic boondoggle, but I think there's ways out there where, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer, because if somebody can make the payments out of the savings, they're really not affecting. You know, eventually the bank is going to get paid back. And I guess what I'm saying is the people live in a more comfortable home. Hopefully it helps the resale value if they ever do have to move. Or maybe you could work it out with landlords, you know, that they could help do some things so that the people could lower their energy bills. But, you know, set up a central fund and have like a low-cost energy bank. But thank you very much.
Hey, well, Gary, before you go, have you heard of this in other states?
Well, I know there's things where they used to say in your mortgage payment, you know, if let's say you were going to borrow money for your first time house and had more energy conservation in it, they would let you borrow a little bit more money towards that house, even if your, you know, income didn't support it, because they knew in the long run that you'd be able to afford it. But I guess what I'm saying is, you know, we talk about, well, if you could just afford that high cost energy heater, you know, especially like a hot water heater, you know, they're way over $1,000. I think some of the lower cost ones now are $1,800. You know, nobody's going to do that when you can go buy an electric hot water heater for $400. But if you could go and now make the sale that maybe the bank could get a lower cost from the manufacturer if they bought 100 of them, you know, now it's $1,600, and they could afford to loan out that $1,600 knowing that people were going to spend $40 less a month on their electric hot water bill. And what I'm saying is that it helps people first time. It gets it up and going, builds, you know, some income for some of these heating contractors that could go out and do this work. And, you know, it seems like everybody would benefit. If there's only a few defaults and the bank still, you know, gets their money back, it just seems like such an easy way to get this going. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much for your call. You know, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah, there may be some, when he said maybe $50 million, there's not $50 million like just hanging around out there. But if it's something that people could save money in the long run, let me also add that Pennsylvania and across the country has a LIHEAP program for low-income individuals. Now, that's a federal program, right?
It's federal and state-run.
Right. That it's something that where those on low incomes can take advantage, get some help with their energy bills. Well, what about this idea of a bank?
So, anyhow, that's not a new idea. It's actually something that we've had in play in Pennsylvania a number of years ago. It was actually called the Keystone Help Program. The tricky part is that you have to have a good network of contractors set up, and you have to essentially make sure that the conservation measures or the efficiency measures that they are implementing are going to perform as expected. So therefore, you don't wind up with these loans in default. Interestingly, recently, Governor Wolf signed into legislation commercial PACE. So that's Property Assessed Clean Energy, which is essentially a loan program that folks are working to set up in Pennsylvania for businesses. So therefore, they can deploy energy efficiency, clean energy types of projects at their business, whereby they are getting a loan. Those loans are going to pay them back over time through their savings, and that loan is essentially attached to their property tax. So in other words, they pay back the loan when they're paying their property tax for the year. So when you have these deeper retrofits, when you have these things that cost more, sometimes folks wonder, hey, am I going to make that investment when I may not be at this property 2 years from now or 3 years from now? Well, since that investment, like new windows, insulation, and HVAC system, is going to stay with the property, you're not going to take it with you, then it increases the value of the property and actually becomes a part of benefit for resale of the property going forward. So there's a commercial PACE program. There's also a residential PACE program, which would be the next step of this. So while Pennsylvania is implementing commercial PACE, the next natural step would be a residential PACE program, which would operate in the same way. It would go through the banks, but essentially you would be making your payments as a part of your annual property tax payment. So therefore, these larger investments would then live on with the property. It would increase the property's value. Folks may be more interested in making those types of investments because they're not having to make that payback within the time period of which they may actually own that property.
We have an email here from Ann who says, we used to buy a washer. Now we buy a washer dryer. A dryer not really needed in our state. A hand towel can dry a body just as good as a big fluffy towel. A counter toaster works just as well as a large stove oven. Same for a bread machine. Towel your dry hair. Hair dryer not needed. Wood sweaters, very cheap at thrift stores. Hand beater works fine to beat eggs. Solar panels are becoming less expensive. I could go on. My electric bill is $15 a month. Allie, I think you probably can understand where she's coming from, but unfortunately not everyone is willing to make those sacrifices.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to convince people to go in a, because in a sense, it's like, for example, hang drying your clothes. It's a very energy efficient process. You're not using any energy to do it. But at the same time, I think for a lot of people who see these brand new fancy technologies with these really cool dryers that have all these special settings, it seems kind of backwards to a lot of people to go from using these new technologies to hang drying your clothes or beating your eggs with a hand beater instead of an electric beater that some new cool technology that you found at your local store. So I definitely, yeah, see that her point exactly, where it is hard to kind of convince people that with all these new cool technologies that have all these capacities, we are actually able to do a lot of the things we use these technologies for without using energy. And to her point on solar and other sources of energy as well, that's another thing that we're seeing a large trend with, is seeing a lot of clean energy really grabbing people's attention and really gaining a lot of traction on the national setting. Even in the last round of elections, we saw a lot of candidates running on the idea of renewable energy sources. And again, as we, I think, was said before, the cleanest energy is the energy that we don't consume in the first place. And if we don't consume as much energy, it will allow that transition to bring in things like solar panels to your home and have those go further if you're using less energy. So I definitely see Anne's point that it's hard for a lot of people to envision how to use less energy. It kind of seems backwards to do things that aren't these new trendy technologies, but at the same time, there are new technologies like solar panels that can really make a big change in the amount of money you're spending per month on your energy bill.
What solar panels, what would it take for my home to be to get solar panels installed that I would use solar nowadays?
Yeah, so, I mean, you would have to go through a process. So it would start similar to an energy audit. You would get someone coming in and telling you kind of the viability of solar on your home. There are certain features of homes such as, so even as much as the angle of the roof can make a big difference in the efficient, like the effectiveness of your roof out hosting a solar panel. So you do the similar thing to an energy audit and get someone to come in and really kind of assess your house to see how solar panels would work and what your benefit would be. And they would put together a sort of cumulative package of all the details of what your solar installation would look like. And from there, you would get the choice if you wanted to move forward. And if so, you would move forward with these contractors kind of to get those solar panels on your home and to move forward in that process.
Okay, but what about cost? Give me a price range.
It definitely varies. I honestly don't know if either of Mark or Dave can give a better idea for Pennsylvania, but I mean, it's a big fluctuation depending on where you are and what kind of rebate programs you have in place and availability of solar in your state.
Okay. I remember now, this was years ago. When I say years ago, 5-6 years ago, that up to $25,000 to get installed. Now, there were some incentives, some tax incentives. Is that ballpark as far as you guys know?
Once again, it depends on the size of your home, the amount of energy that you're going to use, and if you want to zero out the energy use in your home. We're down residential-wise to $3 or $4 a watt. You know, so the point is that if you're consuming about 10,000 kilowatt hours a year, then you're looking at probably $20,000 to $30,000 system. But, you know, that's going to zero out your energy bills, and it's a 25 to 30 year investment, you know, with regards to clean energy, paying a, you know, a $10 or $15 energy bill you know, each month for the rest of the life of your home, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. We have Thomas emailed, says, I was under the impression that heat pumps are not efficient in this area due to the cold temperatures. Is this wrong? I thought that heat pumps worked well in areas that winter weather was not as cold.
Yeah, I mean, heat pumps are very efficient. It's just with an air source heat pump, when you're taking air from the outside at below freezing temperatures, at a certain point, a heat pump will switch to an auxiliary heat. And so that switchover when it's below freezing temperatures becomes less efficient. But for 9 months out of the year, a heat pump is definitely way more efficient than other fuel sources.
Interestingly, at my house, I have a ground source heat pump. So I am exchanging with the ground, which is a constant 55 degree temperature. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, that system is optimized to exchange with 55 degrees. And so my system is just as efficient in January as it is in July.
Mm. We have another comment here. What is the split, the percentage of energy consumption between places of business and residential properties? What are businesses doing to reduce their energy consumption and encourage employees or patrons to reduce their impact while on the premises? Ali, I'll ask you that question. I mean, it would be beneficial for a business to do this because it goes right to the bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of the simple, like a lot of the changes you can make in a home, for example, more efficient technologies, like shutting off your lights, switching to LEDs, things like that, are all equally as important for businesses to do. But on a larger scale, there's also a lot of building retrofits that can be made to increase a business's efficiency in that sense. So, for example, getting a building's net energy down by making sure insulation is well done and making building codes that require certain levels of energy retrofits and weatherization to maximize the efficiency of buildings. So I think in a lot of senses, things that can be done in the home can be equally done in a business space. But as we are, as speaking of a more larger buildings and kind of these more business industrial buildings, I think building codes are really important, and energy retrofits and weatherization and kind of building those into what are required while building these larger buildings is a really important feature in making sure that we have high efficiency buildings that are making the most out of their energy and really reducing their energy consumption overall.
I would say that I totally agree with that. Whether it's commercial businesses or industrial businesses, it's a lot of the same. It's a lot of the same energy conservation measures are you know equally well received, whether it's residential or commercial. In fact, DEP has a grant program that helps businesses. It's called the Small Business Advantage Grant. We provide 50% matching grants up to a maximum of $9,500 to enable small businesses to purchase energy-efficient equipment. Small business must save at least a minimum of $500 or 25% annually in energy consumption, and it's energy-efficient lighting, high-efficiency furnaces, boilers and air conditioners, geothermal heat pumps, refrigeration processes, all of those things. That's currently open right now. So in addition to the Act 129, checking into your electric distribution company, what rebates they may have, there's a program that we're running every year out of our Department of Environmental Protection called the Small Business Advantage Grant. Go to www.dep.pa.gov and search for Small Business Advantage Grant to find out more about that.
We had a follow-up on the solar panels. April wanted to know, is there anything recently as an incentive to get solar panels?
Not really. I mean, there's the federal tax credit that's available, and so that's been available for some time. As far as
which is a 30% tax credit, 30% of the cost of the install price of the solar panels.
Yeah.
Well, now we only have about 3 minutes left, and Ali, I wanted to talk a little bit about the guide, Time to Take Charge, A Citizen's Guide to Saving Energy. By the way, we have a link on our website, WITF.org, to that guide. But quickly, what are some of the energy-saving tips that you offer in the guide?
Yeah, so our guide, like I said before, is really supposed to be a resource where people can find the point that they're most comfortable with making adjustments in their home where they'll still see benefits. So there are small steps like changing your light bulbs to LEDs, as I talked about earlier, unplugging or changing settings on some of those energy vampires I talked about, such as your TV and cable boxes, making sure those are actually powered down when you're done using them and not just in standby mode where they're still consuming energy. And similarly with certain electronics, such as like your microwave actually uses more energy in 1 year to show time than it does actually heating your food. So there's just these things that people don't necessarily think about that are pretty small changes that, for example, if you have a microwave that you can put on low energy setting or even just turning the brightness down, those things are really small changes that can make some sort of difference in your energy bill. And then moving up, there's the things like heating and cooling, where you rethink about how you heat and cool your home, like small adjustments like putting curtains in your window that help block out the sun in the summer to make sure that your home is already cooler so your cooling system has to do less work, so much to, as we talked about, transitioning to a heat pump or something of that sort that's more efficient. And then on a more large scale, also things like in your transportation, choosing to take public transit or walk or bike places that are closer to your home. Leaving your car at home 2 days a week can make a really big impact on the amount of CO2 or greenhouse gases you're putting into the atmosphere, and can also save you money because you're not using gas. And then, for, as we talked about, solar panels on your home or other forms of renewable energy that you can get to power your home, those can make a big difference in your energy costs and be a lot more clean than other energy sources. And then just back to the basics that we've talked about a lot, weatherizing your home, making sure your insulation is proper, having storm windows, and opting for energy-efficient appliances. Those are all things that our guide covers. And again, it's supposed to be a resource that people can look at and find what they think is most feasible for them, but still be able to make some form of change in their home that saves them money, but also saves energy.
Mark, you actually, I want to get this straight. You actually built a home?
I actually, yeah, we, my family worked with an architect and a custom home builder about, I don't know, several years ago, 2008, 2009. And I was really into green homes, and it was just, you know, it's very interesting to me. So we went through the whole process and built a super insulated passive solar house, which is where all the windows are, or most of the windows are facing south orientation. So you have heat gain in the wintertime, and certified it to Energy Star. And so it was a very interesting experience.
Sounds that way. Hey, I want to thank you all for being with us today. Dave Althoff is the Director of Energy Programs. Mark Hanna, Energy Program Specialist, both with the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. And Allie Asters, a Clean Energy Associate with Penn Environment. And they're a time to take charge, a citizen's guide to saving energy. That guide is on our website, WITF.org. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's program, yes, it is Thanksgiving week, and Chef Donna Desfort will be with us tomorrow. We will be talking about Thanksgiving dinner, looking for your ideas. Look for something different. Maybe you have something different going on this Thanksgiving as far as dinner is concerned, your plans, just your traditions overall. Always have a lot of fun with that program. That's coming up on tomorrow's show. The condition of Pennsylvania's forests is the best it has been in more than 100 years. They are not only important to the quality of life, but our forests are often an essential part of our economy. California is experiencing an unprecedented fire season, and while our states do not share the same fire risk factors, it is important to know what we are doing to prevent the same kind of devastation. Joining us on today's program is Matt Kiefer, Assistant Pennsylvania State Forester, and Michael Kern, who is the Chief Forest Fire Warden here in Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Morning.
Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. First of all, I want to start off by asking, I mean, I'm sure this is something that you two probably follow a little closer than what just us and the general population do, of what is happening in California right now. Your thoughts on what you're observing, what you're hearing?
Yeah, I mean, we do at least in my end of the forestry profession, I follow national wildfire activity almost daily. It has been a real tragedy with the loss of life, and our thoughts are really with those people. But California is a little bit different situation. The weather's a lot different. Their climate, their terrain, the population. It's just a lot different situation than here in Pennsylvania.
But yet we still here in Pennsylvania have the risk of forest fire, maybe not to the extent that they do in California. So how does Pennsylvania compare?
Well, I think probably the risk of real catastrophic wildfire is lower than California. There's certainly, there's places in Pennsylvania where there's populations in the wildlands that are similar, not as widespread or as dense. So, there's certainly a risk here. I'd say it's lower overall.
Mm-hmm. Overall, when I said California's forest fire season or wildfire season. By the way, what's the difference between a wildfire and a forest fire? Is there any difference?
Not really. We prefer to use the term wildfire. That's a more descriptive term, I think. It's, fires can occur any land where there's natural vegetation that's available to burn. So it could be grass, brush. People say forest fire. They tend to think of trees, mm-hmm. Obviously forests. But we can have wildfires in any type of land like that. So
I heard somebody say, just in talking about this last week, that actually, we've had a deer problem here in Pennsylvania with deer causing some real problems to the forest, but that it has actually helped when it's come to wildfires because some of the ground vegetation that the deer, you're kind of rolling your eyes. Yeah.
Yes and no. Likely more not.
Okay.
Our highest risk of wildfires are where you have a lot of dense fuel like mountain laurel or a lot of downed trees that may have been killed by insects or some kind of storm. And the deer aren't going to have an impact on those.
Okay.
Those types of things.
So there's a non-factor. I heard somebody on the street say it, and they didn't know what they're talking about.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm saying glad you said right. Well, let's talk about Pennsylvania's forest situation. As I said there in the introduction, that our forests are as healthy as they have been in the last 100 years. How would you describe that?
Well, the good thing is we have a lot of forest. We have about 17 million acres. About 70% of those are owned by private individuals, the rest owned by government agencies. So in that regard, we have a healthy forest in that we have a lot of trees. Certainly, though, we do have our suite of insects and diseases. We have the emerald ash borer, the hemlock woolly adelgid, gypsy moth cycles in and out, and a host of invasive plants. So while the forest is green, we have a lot of challenges, but we are fortunate to have as many acres of forest as we do, and the values that they provide, with wood, clean water, wildlife habitat, and recreation opportunities for our citizens.
Okay, did you say 17 million acres?
17 million.
Okay. That's kind of hard to imagine. How does that compare? What percentage of the state is forested?
It's about 60%.
See, that may surprise a lot of people because, when here in the southeastern part of the state, especially, there are a lot of urban areas, suburbs. We have lost a lot of forest land. But there probably are a lot of people that don't realize once you get above, like, say, I-80, maybe even below that, that there is, I won't say nothing but forest, but a whole lot of forest.
Right. Even if you travel a little bit west of the Harrisburg area, for example, if you go south into where the Michaux Forest is, that's what the landscape looks like up north and west of here, where you have forest in the mountains and some agriculture in the valleys. But yes, north of Route 80, it's 80 to 90% forest in some areas.
Michaux is one of the biggest, right?
It's one of our smaller areas of state forest.
Oh, really? Really? Okay.
For example, we have the Sproul and Bald Eagle State Forests up north, and they are about 300,000 acres in size.
Mm-hmm. What's Michaux?
Michaux is 85,000.
Okay. All right. So when we say, and I want to go back to what you were talking about with the invasive insects, the invasive species, but at the same time, we're saying that Pennsylvania's forests are as healthy as they've been in 100 years. That may surprise many when we hear so often about those invasive insects, invasive species. The ash borer, and I keep hearing that we may not have ash trees in Pennsylvania before long because of this insect. This green-spotted lanternfly is another new one that we've heard about here in the last few years or so. So it may surprise some people to hear that the forests are as healthy as they've been in 100 years.
I thought about something. So if you look at Pennsylvania's history, 100 or 125 years ago, this state, we had exploited our forests to the point where there was people in this state that were actually concerned that we would run out of wood. And Gifford Pinchot famously said, we have enough wood to build a coffin for a person, but not to build a house for them. So we can bury them, but we can't keep them alive. And that was because of just basically rampant clear cutting. The country was in an industrial revolution, and we had this appetite for wood, basically, and we were just cutting down trees as fast as we could grow them.
So that's actually a success story in the past 100 years.
Yeah, if you look at the amount of forests that we had 100 years ago, we had less forests than we have now because we had liquidated them, basically. So it is a success story in a way. As Matt said, there's a lot of green out there. There's a lot of forests. Obviously, we're concerned about the health of those forests, but, at least we have them.
What can you do, Matt, to control these invasive species and invasive plants?
Well, a lot of effort we put into basic education and outreach so that people are aware of, say, what's the next big invader, or if there's one that's recently established, how do we do our best to control the spread or the impact? But the challenge is, being a global society, the pests are moving globally on shipping containers, airplanes. So we're finding it's at some level, it's almost impossible to stop things from being introduced. So at that point, it's about education and outreach. The other thing that we do when you relating it back to a healthy forest is managing for diversity and forest health, so that if you have a diverse group of different types of trees, so species composition, you're less vulnerable to an impact of a single invasive bug or disease or a plant. So more diverse and more resilient to the impacts, whether it be invasives or weather events or things like climate change and even fire.
President Trump said this weekend, and I'm going to get this out of the way, he talked about California, if they just rake the forest like they do in Finland. Now, I understand that Finland came back and said that, we don't rake the forest floor, but we do have forest protection programs. What are some of those programs, and is it something that we utilize here in Pennsylvania?
From a basic fire prevention standpoint, yes, we advise folks to keep the areas around their homes clear. So if you have a lawn or if you have shrubs, you can certainly keep that vicinity clean if you're in an area that's heavily wooded or prone to fires. However, raking or cleaning the forest on a large scale
just can't happen.
It's not feasible, and it's not something that we'd want to do from an environmental standpoint. That leaf litter, those fine twigs, are very important ecologically as well.
Mm-hmm. Wildlife and everything else that live off that. So, Michael, let me ask you, let's get back to some of the fire dangers. What does cause most of the forest fires or wildfires here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so here in Pennsylvania, over 95% of all our wildfires are caused by humans. The two main causes actually being people burning debris at their house, so they might be burning, whether it's limbs and branches or leaves or, you know, cleaning up their yard, landscaping debris. Also sometimes trash, you know, disposing of trash in areas where that's allowed. Those fires can get out of hand fairly quickly when the wrong weather's occurring. And then another big cause of fires in Pennsylvania is actually, we call them intentionally set. You know, they may be arson, but for whatever reason, somebody goes and lights the forest on fire. So,
campfires, would that...
Campfires are not a real big cause of wildfires in this state, to be perfectly honest. I'm not sure. It's just not statistically really a big cause.
We have an email here from Kit who says, in Lycoming County and many other counties in Pennsylvania, damage from flash floods and heavy thunderstorms have done devastating damage to forest roads far beyond the budgets of most townships. A forest fire in those areas would deny normal access to fight a potential forest fire. Are there any plans to deal with affecting repairs to those roads? Is there any contingency plans in place? Is this a big problem?
I think it's in some local areas I've heard, you know, that there is a... that road systems have been severely impacted. And I know like some of our state forest roads were, and I believe a lot of those municipalities or townships are working through FEMA or PEMA, because there was in some cases, a emergency declarations that makes funding available for emergency repairs.
She brings up a point though, when she's talking about flash floods, heavy thunderstorms. You mentioned climate change, and I know that this is a big topic of discussion when it comes to California. Have we seen the effects of climate change here in Pennsylvania?
I think with the intensity of the storms that we're seeing and, the higher frequency of those storms, it sure seems like it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you say, though, that there has been an impact on the forest land of Pennsylvania?
In the short term, I don't know if you can say that. I think there is some concern about tree species being adapted to a certain type of weather that we've had and then that changing quickly. You know, I've heard some talk about eastern white pine is having trouble dealing with the moisture. And it's causing, when it's moist like that, it can cause like mold and different diseases that the trees aren't normally used to dealing with. So,
or do we have species here in Pennsylvania that we wouldn't have seen, maybe just because of a few more months or a few more weeks of warmer weather?
I don't think the species composition is changing that quickly yet. But one of the impacts that we are definitely seeing are early bud burst. Mm. So in late winter, when you have some warm weather, the trees begin, you know, to uptake the water and begin growing, and then they might get injured with a late frost. That seems to be happening more often and at different extremes that the trees are not used to.
Getting back to wildfires, the months when we most often see wildfires here in Pennsylvania, and I'm going to tie that into what you were just talking about.
Yeah, the peak of our wildfire season is April in Pennsylvania. There's no leaves in the trees. The weather's warmed up. The snow's melted, but the vegetation's still not green. So, the forest, the fuels and dead material in the forest can dry out real quick, and leads to wildfires. It's also, I learned last week, April is the lowest humidity, so the air is the driest in Pennsylvania. Any time of the year, April is by far the driest for relative humidity. So.
I have to admit that one of the things that surprised me, though, as I was looking into this, is that even though April, the spring months, when most wildfires occur here in Pennsylvania, actually October and November are 2 months where we see them compared to some of the other months as well.
Yeah, so you have the, you know, I said in the spring, things haven't greened up yet. Well, in the fall, you know, traditionally...
They've browned up.
Yes. The leaves, you know, they turn color and they... brown, they fall off the trees. So if you have a period where the leaves are down, but before winter sets in, before it starts to snow, you can get wildfires then also. So.
Well, we're just going to end the program by saying be very careful out there, especially when you're burning trash. Matt Kiefer, Assistant Pennsylvania State Forester, Michael Kern, Chief Forest Fire Warden here in Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, again, we talk Thanksgiving dinner of Chef Donna Desfour. That's coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk Show, so be sure to tune in.